You're listening to episode 26 of Fear the Boots interview series. This is the first half of our interview with Mark Kalmus. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 5 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Johan.
My name is Pat.
This is Jock.
And joining us today is a guest from Goblin Works, Mark Kalmus.
Hello.
All right, now we're getting back to who Mark is, apart from the fact that he's with Goblin Works and what he's into, what he does. We have all kinds of questions for him about all kinds of different stuff, but there's some business we need to get out of the way for the show first. The postcards contest is now complete, and I mean complete in the sense that we have all of our finalists. So as of the release of this episode, there will be a link in the show notes where you can go and begin voting on the finalists to pick the grand prize winner. And we will allow that voting to run for at least several weeks through mid-January, maybe the end of January. We'll just see kind of where voting's at, and we'll make a call on that probably around the start of the new year. But nonetheless, that is up. All right, I want to talk about Mark's history, you know, where he's been, what he's done, what's led him up to where he is today. But before we get to that, Mark, you said that you've got some news that you are willing to break on our show, which by all means, I'm happy to let you do. And then John also gave me a question that I've got to get off my chest. But first, let's begin.
I don't remember what it was.
I do. Okay. But first, let's begin with your announcement. What is the Land Rush?
All right. So we're announcing the Guild Land Rush, and this is our way of allocating the initial land in the game. What we'd like to do is look at the top guilds going into beta, and we'll rank them in order of the number of players they have in beta, and we'll just draft pieces of land from that list. So we'll put up somewhere between 18, 35 plots of land, and that land will be drafted by the initial guilds in the game. We're excited about it. It's going to be kind of a fun way of getting started, and it figures into our whole method through beta of slowly ramping up the game in a natural fashion. We don't want to just have a crazy melee to start the game with. We want people to get into the game and have some structure around them and immediately see who the popular guilds are and have some, you know, workable land space. There'll still be plenty of land if you don't participate in the land rush initially. We're going to open up a lot more hexes after the period, as soon as we get some combat in the game and things like that in late beta, they'll open up plenty more land, and then you can stake your claim out in that area. But if you get into the Kickstarter, you'll get into the initial land rush.
Okay, Mark, I have to ask you a historical question.
Sure.
Were you there on the night that Trammel opened in Ultima Online?
No, I wasn't a UO player.
Okay, well, that was the greatest land rush in the history of time, because not only was there far too little land supply and far too much demand for the player housing base, but Trammel was the new instance where nobody could kill each other. So we are all used to resolving conflict by throwing spells at one another and murdering each other. And suddenly the one resource that we all want the most is plopped in front of us, and we can't fight over it. So all this sabotage took place. Like, people would line these clearings with boxes so no one else could place their house, and then bring all their guild out to like push them away. It sounds like your method is probably a bit more sane.
I hope so.
I don't know if this is fun.
And I have a lot of mechanical questions about how land will be distributed and claimed and things like that. And there's obviously a lot in general we're going to ask you about this MMO throughout the course of the interview. That's not really where I want to start. But for anyone that's listening, hold on, because just because I'm not asking right this second doesn't mean we won't come back to it. I've got 2 pages of notes in front of me of things that I'd like to cover during the course of this interview. But one of the things that I did want to ask you is, if someone is involved in this land rush, how do you guys tell them they're in the land rush? How do they work with you to pick the land? Is this done through the forums? Is this done through email because they back the Kickstarter? What's the mechanics behind it?
That's a great question, because I don't have an answer to it.
Okay.
What we're going to do initially, we're actually setting up a thread on the Paizo forums where we'll list out all of the guilds we know that are in the game so far. There's already a list of 30 or so guilds, and we'll allow you just to vote on that and basically say that I'm planning to be in beta and I'm planning to belong to this guild. Obviously, this is not protected in any way. Somebody could fudge the results a little bit.
So but vote it'll give like you it's the NEs.
Exactly. But you'll get an idea of what guilds are popular, and you'll start seeing, you know, how the population is shaking out.
So are these guilds player created, or are they created by you guys?
Player created, and the initial set of guilds is all the people who pledged at the guild forger level in the Kickstarter. So you can buy a 6-pack of accounts, essentially. That's a guild pack.
And just so you know, I am the guy who had no idea who you were before showing up tonight, doesn't play MMOs, and doesn't watch Kickstarters. So I will ask all of the stupid questions for the evening as we go along.
We'll try to get you sold by the end of the show.
Well, and he is replacing a guy who is a big City of Heroes, City of Villains fans, which is actually where I want to start this interview. Martin, tell us where you've been, what you've done, because obviously you did not just poof out of thin air working at Goblin Works. You had some history before. Where have you been?
So, yeah, the CTO of Goblin Works, so I'm kind of the master programmer. I'm the one who gets blamed if the servers go down or something like that.
Oh, you're not good at this game.
Yeah.
If you're a developer and don't know how to blame the hardware people, you have not played this game well.
Oh, that's true. But in today's cloud world, you just have this amorphous cloud of hardware, and it still ends up being your fault.
Then you blame the service provider.
You also have a cloud of fans who are on your forums or on their forums blaming everyone and anyone. So that's harder to deal with.
All right. But I'm sorry. Go on.
So, yeah, I got my start in the industry with Cryptic Studios working on the City of Heroes. They actually got my name from Top Coder. It was just an online contest website where I was doing contests, you know, programming contests. And they invited me out. I actually flew out during my honeymoon. And I told them for the interview, I told them they had to get me out there and back within 24 hours because I couldn't be gone from my honeymoon for too long.
You're still paying California. For that, aren't you?
No, my wife is awesome. I never pay for these things. So I flew out to San Jose and interviewed with the Cryptic folks and had a great time. We built up City of Heroes. City of Heroes was very much a small production. You know, it came in that first age of MMOs where all the productions were that small. We actually shipped City of Heroes with just 21 people in the company. So it was Yeah, it was a relatively small scale project.
It was very done for having nobody working on it. Well done by any standard, actually.
I played it at release, dropped it for a while, then picked it up again with City of Villains, dropped it again for a while, then picked it up again not long before Going Rogue came out. I played it kind of in three phases. There was someone on our forums who wanted to know, so I have to ask, were you, and if not you, then who was responsible for the Mastermind class?
Oh, no, I was not responsible for the Mastermind class, but
you should have said you were. You'd have won a fan for life.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to point out a programmer who is responsible. I would say Martin Simpson. He was the AI programmer. I would put him as most responsible because he created this really well-tuned AI system that was able to handle these huge number of critters. That figured into the Mastermind class, you know, us just being able to give you this crazy number of critters that followed a player around and followed you all over the zone and did just all kinds of fun stuff.
That was one of the things that I appreciated about both City of Heroes and City of Villains was the amount of detail that went into the characters. I mean, at character creation, I mean, you could spend hours and hours and hours fine-tuning exactly what you wanted your character to look like, picking the colors and matching the parts and all that kind of stuff. And then, of course, as the game developed, you could get the different colored effects and you could get capes and you could get all kinds of other stuff. But it also did a great job of capturing the feel of a comic book character. And I think the Mastermind class is probably one of the classes that does the best job of demonstrating that. Because if you look through so many of the iconic villains, people like Lex Luthor, the Joker, whatever, they're not individually impressive. It's the fact that they surround themselves by so many other people that create this wall of problem for the good guys. Some of your summons were notably more powerful than you were. It was something that I really appreciated in the game. Now, a question that I have for you is, were you there when City of Heroes closed down?
No. City of Heroes first got sold to NCSoft. So Cryptic Studios had a publishing relationship with NCSoft. As the relationship evolved, Cryptic Studios wanted to move on to new projects. NCSoft wanted to keep City of Heroes going. And NCSoft ended up buying City of Heroes, including several of the developers, and making a new studio called Paragon Studios. So that's where Paragon Studios came from. That happened while I was there, but then that studio went on for, I would say, at least 3 or 4 years before they finally just had shut down the game.
The reason I ask is because it's just so rare anymore for an MMO to shut down. I mean, sure, it happens, but it's much more frequent for them to go to a free-to-play model or some kind of a freemium model. You know, they'll condense the servers, but they will still keep the game running in some form.
I think that's unfortunately one of the downsides of the free-to-play model. So City of Heroes actually did go to free-to-play quite a while before it shut down. The unfortunate downside of going to free-to-play is that you have a fairly high fixed server cost. And then over time, if your player base gets used to the game and stops purchasing items from your store, you stop getting any revenue coming in. And a lot of games like Ultima Online just ran forever on some computer in a closet because they still had subscribers. Once you've stopped the subscriptions and you go free to play, we're just starting to see this new type of shutdown mode where you stop pulling in enough revenue to run the server. So you actually do have to shut down the game. It's definitely different than it used to be.
Yeah, I remember when Asheron's Call 2 shut down. I was like, what? That can happen? That's never happened before. I'm confused.
It didn't surprise me.
Well, it was terrible, but it still surprised me.
It is probably the biggest $50 regret of my life. That was a freaking awful game.
Did you buy Daikatana?
No, I didn't buy Daikatana. You know what really was a shame about that, too, is Asheron's Call 1 got such great reviews, you know, at least from kind of the cult following that it had.
It couldn't get out from behind EverQuest. It came out when EQ was like, we think WoW has a big portion of the MMO market share today. Everyone played EQ 12 years ago.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't even remember.
Okay, Johan, you don't play MMOs.
You don't play MMOs.
Last time I played an MMO, it was text-based, and I logged in with Telnet.
So. Actually, the last time I played an MMO, it was also text-based, but I logged in with the Stormfront front-end because I am still a mutter.
So, not talking isometric here. I'm talking first-person, or at least a third-person floating camera here. Do you know what I believe the first MMO was? It wasn't EverQuest.
You probably believe it was Meridian 59.
I thought 69. Yes.
59. No, Meridian 69 was another game entirely.
And that's just how I like to remember
it. That's what
it.
Pat played.
Yes.
Yes, I believe you're correct.
I believe it was Meridian. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but that's my understanding.
I've certainly heard that before from multiple semi-credible sources, by which I mean Games Press.
All right.
Which I suppose we are at this point. Wow.
No, we're entertainment. I was asked that question once in a panel for Press Entertainment, and I responded, we were entertainment.
That's right.
All right, so let's keep moving around here. Mark Robotics, your profile says that you're involved in robotics. What do you do in robotics?
Sure. I do a little bit of research. So right now I have a servo arm. It's a full robotic arm, and I'm teaching it to play chess. In particular, it's a little hard to explain, but in particular, I'm applying probabilistic methods to computer vision problems. So a lot of Bayesian inference methods and things like that to modern day computer vision algorithms. So
give me an ETA on the first robot DM, because I need one.
Ooh, that would be fantastic. Well, if we get that, then we'll build it in the game. Absolutely.
Will you teach it to take care of elderly Japanese people?
I think the Japanese are taking care of that. They're on that.
They are.
You have to break into that market. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I'm just planning to take over the world.
There you go.
Please do not teach it global thermonuclear war. Or if you do, make it run a simulation like 10,000 times in 5 minutes so that it realizes that the only way to win is not to play.
I'm just going straight for the singularity, just, you know, super smart computers. And then fortunately, I think they assassinate me first and then go on to the rest of the world.
Sometimes if you're indispensable, they just enslave you. But yeah, they'll probably.
Right. Have you tried putting an unloaded pistol in front of it just to see what it does?
It looks at it suspiciously.
I'd be kind of curious. You know,
it tries to move it to E5.
Yeah, lay out the chessboard, then next to the chessboard, put down the pistol, start beating its ass at chess, and just see what happens. I think that might be a good test run of where this is headed.
Right. I'll keep the pistol unloaded, so it'll be
it doesn't need to know that. That's what it's going to have to learn, okay? Yeah. And once it learns the gun's unloaded and therefore harmless, now you've caught it early enough, okay? This is like catching stage one cancer. You know, you can deal with it at this point.
Well, this is why periodically at work I grab my server rack, wheel it outside, and line it up so it can watch as I bust hard drives with a sledgehammer just to make sure it understands who the boss is. Then I wheel it back into place and...
Do you play rap music in the background while you're doing this?
Yeah. Not deliberately, but yes, actually, often there is rap music playing in the background.
Ghetto Boys still. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever play A Mind Forever Voyaging?
It's
a text-based game where you were an AI and you had to overcome that problem. You were a good AI, you had to kill evil people, and they had sledgehammers and you didn't. It was fun. I think you had to vent the whole facility of oxygen or something. It's been a long time. It's an ancient game, but it's good.
All right, let's get down now to the MMOs, meat and potatoes here of this interview. One of the first questions I want to ask you is, what exactly is the relationship between Goblin Works and Paizo? And I ask this because there's been a lot of public-facing disclaimers that Goblin Works is this unique entity, yet it shares the same space as the Paizo forums. It shares the same space on the Paizo site. There's obviously a lot of people from Paizo that are involved in working on the Pathfinder MMO. So I was wondering if you talk about what the relationship is and is not between Goblinworks and Paizo.
Sure. Goblinworks is an independent company. The only employee we have in common between the companies is Lisa Stevens, who is obviously CEO of Paizo, and she is COO of Goblinworks. We are across the lobby in the same building. We really want to have a close working relationship with Paizo so that as we develop the game and we develop ideas for how Pathfinder gets interpreted in an online environment, we get to run that by the designers on the Paizo side pretty often. And we try to meet with them. I think we have a design meeting every week scheduled so that they can hear what we're doing and make sure that we kind of constantly stay in sync. But it's definitely two completely different companies. We're in a different office space. We don't always see those guys every day. The forums probably make it look like the companies are more intertwined than they are. It really comes down to I've been too lazy to set up our own Goblinworks forums. And so it's really easy for us just to piggyback on the Paizo forums. What's great is that we get to piggyback on the culture of the Paizo forums and a set of people that work and have a good conversation going. So there's a lot of advantages just to us being there, but that probably makes a look of companies are more intertwined than they really are.
When you go to do the MMO, how close are you going to stay to the Pathfinder rules? Because this is a question that I've seen struggled with for as long as there have been D&D-based games. Now, obviously, Pathfinder is technically a separate intellectual property, but it came out of the OGL and D20. But I mean, going all the way back to the gold box games, that stuck pretty freaking close to the tabletop rules. And then they started to stray a little bit more once you got to things like Baldur's Gate and Neverwinter Nights, until eventually you hit the D&D MMO where they had strayed pretty far into the realm of action. And I'm curious, when you guys create this game, because I know you've at least gotten through a tech demo, and I know you've at least gotten through a lot of paperwork, even though there's still obviously a small number of years worth of development to do here. But sure. In your intention, how much is this game going to play like the tabletop versus how much are you guys going to have to change just because it's a different medium?
Well, definitely the OGL gets in the way a little bit. We obviously can't take a lot of canonical Dungeons & Dragons spells and items and port them to the game because we're just not licensed to do that, right? So everything we come up with really has to come out of the Pathfinder universe, which is cool. We like the Pathfinder universe. In terms of overall feel, I think I would compare it most to Dungeons & Dragons Online, you know, where they obviously try to make as many correlations and references to the rules as possible. But at the same time, everything's a little different because it is action oriented. We are going to have that same push on us. I think we will end up feeling hopefully just like your Pathfinder game, but the nature of the sandbox game has pushed us a little bit farther even in that we're probably not going to have classes exactly as they are in the game.
Good. I hate class-based MMO. I want skill-based.
Okay, no, I agree, but yeah, explain that one, because that's a pretty big,
it's a big
shift.
Change.
It's a pretty big push, so
sure.
How will a character look? I create a character and I am what?
Well, we want you absolutely to be able to say, well, I want to make a fighter.
Okay.
But when you say, I want to make a fighter, the system will kind of cue you into, if you want to level up to a level 5 fighter, what you really want to do is invest in the following 20 skills, and that will mean that you are a level 5 fighter. So it'll kind of cue you into a much broader spectrum of just skill-based things. So you'll have a skill in armor and a skill in your sword and even a skill way of boosting your HP over time. The selection of skills is kind of very, very broad and lets you do a lot of things. And the virtue for a sandbox game is that you can be leveling up your fighter for months and getting better and better at fighting. But then let's say see somebody who's having a really good time crafting, who's finding some ore in the hills and has brought it down and started crafting daggers for the thieves in the town. And you decide, I want to get along with this game and I want to try this out for a little bit. You can take some time and put some XP into those skills that are not directly related to your class and just try them out for a little while. And in the same way, you try out actually some spells, even if you are mainly a fighter.
Okay, several questions there then. First off, where does XP come from?
So we're doing an XP over time system, which is similar to EVE Online, if you've seen that system.
Yes, mm-hmm. I played EVE.
It's funny, it's kind of an evolution. A lot of the classless systems were what they called use-based for a long time. So as you hacked down trees, you got better and better at carpentry and at hacking down trees. It gets to be very repetitive and very grindy over time. The virtue of the time-based system is that you're sidestepping the whole issue of the grind. On the negative side, you know, some people don't like that they don't have that immediate gratification of going to do something. So we have a little bit of a hybrid system in that you constantly gain XP over time, but you don't get to really ding a new level in your sword fighting skill, say, until you've achieved some sort of achievement related to sword fighting. And that may be, I've killed these goblins, or in the case of other skills, it may just be, I've explored lots of different areas, or, you know, I've grouped with lots of different people in different types of parties. And so there's kind of an achievement system that is intermingled with the leveling up system.
Now, I'm not familiar with the Eve system. I obviously didn't play it myself. Now, when you talk about this, so you gain XP over time, is this while you're actively playing the game, or is rested XP do anything?
No, there's not a distinct rested XP system. It's just constant time. So whether you're logged in or logged off, you're constantly generating.
Okay, I would want to start this, make like 5 vaults right at once, and just let them sit there, and they would be gaining XP even though I'm not playing them actively?
Well, your account will only have one character that is gaining XP at any time. So, you know, you've subscribed to one account, and that account has one player gaining XP over time.
Okay.
You don't really need alts as much in this type of game because you are your own alt. You can always just go do something else for a little while. Put away your sword, put away your big shield, put away your heavy armor, and go, you know, learn some clerical skills for a little while. You get to sample all these different fields without feeling like you need to constantly change out the character.
One of the things that I ran into while playing Eve that I know they tried to do some things to blunt here pretty recently, but I'm curious what you guys intend to do to deal with these problems. First off, because of the fact that skills have to be learned over time, it really felt like I came into the game not capable of doing really much of anything. And if I wanted to participate in anything worth doing, I join a guild or whatever, it was typically going to be at minimum a couple months before I really had the skills to contribute in any meaningful way. Much in the same way that if I was playing in a level-based system, if they're a level 30, I've got to rush my way up to level 30 in order to run with them, which, as you know, in City of Heroes and City of Villains, they got around by doing mentoring and sidekicking and all that kind of stuff to kind of fudge the level system. But I'm curious, what do you guys intend to do, if anything, about the fact, let's say Pat's been playing this game for 6 months, and he says, hey, Dan, you ought to pick it up, and so I pick it up, and I'm like, well, crap, why would I want to play this game? I can't do anything with anybody.
The quick answer is that our leveling curve is very, very small compared to most kind of level-based theme park games. So in City of Heroes, for instance, there's just no comparison between the level 1 character and even a level 20 or a level 30 character, let alone a level 50 character. They're literally 100 times more powerful at level 20 than they are at level 1. Our curve, even after you've trained for several years and have fully leveled up your fighter, you're still only maybe 5 times as effective as an initial character. So just the total number of people that are engaged and are going on an adventure together is by far the most important determiner of what you're going to be able to fight and what challenges you can take on. You just don't have these crazy, crazy disparate levels where people just can't group together. It's fine for you to group with your buddy who's been there for 6 months. He's going to be more effective, and more than that, he'll have more options in combat than you do and more interesting things that he can throw in there, but you're still going to be able to hang in the fight with him.
Are there actually levels? Do you level your fighter or your cleric, or is that just sort of an expression?
It's a little fuzzy right now, but what we plan to do is, because it's just too hard to describe your character without being able to say, I'm a level 10 fighter.
Yeah.
We want to be able to express that level 10 fighter, and that essentially the fact that you're a level 10 fighter means that you have a big list of skills. And if you've done all those skills, then you are a level 10 fighter, and you get a small boon attached to the fact that you're a fighter. So you become a little bit faster at swinging a weapon and things like that as you level up your core fighting skill. So it draws you into wanting to do a class, while at the same time underlying that all of your skills are kind of independently bought. You get to do a little bit of your own selection of what type of fighter you are.
To keep drawing this back to Eve, which I don't think is an unfair comparison given the history of the CEO of the company.
Sure.
For anyone who's not familiar, the CEO of the company is Ryan Dancy, who worked over at CCP White Wolf on Eve for quite some time.
I came from Eve as well.
Figured Atlanta. Probably.
Yeah. Okay. That's
the first thing. I worked on the World of Darkness project with the White Wolf folks.
Oh, okay. What you're describing kind of reminds me of an Eve is the cert system, except it sounds like achieving the certs actually does something. For us, not for what I'm talking about. Eve has this massive skill tree that's very hard to follow. One of the things they tried to do more recently to simplify that is they created what they called a certification system. So if you want to say that I am an electronics warfare pilot, there might be certain certifications that say I am specced out to pilot a frigate, I am specced out to operate these systems, and each of those would then be a certification that consists of constituent skills. So you need to know skills A, B, and C in order to earn the certification. And so it does two things. One, if you're trying to plan out your character, it helps you understand, oh, I need this skill, and this skill to get there. And if someone's trying to check you out, they don't have to go through a mile-long skill tree. They can look at your certs to pretty quickly get an idea of what it is you're actually good at. Now, in Eve, they were pretty much just a shorthand, whereas it sounds like here, achieving a cert will also unlock an additional cert-related perk, though in this case, we're calling the cert levels in a class as opposed to a certification.
And actually, it's interesting. Lee Hammock came from Fallen Earth. He's our lead designer, and he made a post-apocalyptic MMO called Fallen Earth, and they also had a skill-based system. And similarly, they had the same problem that you can't just present people with 100 skills and ask them to start choosing. It's just too complicated. So they would allow people to choose something along these lines of a class or cert. I don't remember what they are called in Fallen Earth, but they chose a path. And I think that system actually automatically leveled them up in the appropriate skills based on the path that they had chosen. I think all of these games are coming to similar ways of trying to group together a large number of skills. I think one advantage we're going to have is that we'll try to keep the classes and these levels a little more sparse. We're not really looking at a list of 100 different possible certifications. We're looking at the traditional Pathfinder classes. And what that lets us do is I'm hoping that when you are geared up as a fighter, then you're going to meaning when other people see you and select your character, they will immediately see that you are a level 8 fighter or a level 12 or whatever level you are. It's a lot easier to quickly assess people and understand what their role is and what they're planning to do.
Now, do you have to flip in and out of roles? Let's say, for example, that I've gotten, I'm just making this up, 5 levels in fighter and 5 levels in cleric. Do I have to play one or the other, or am I effectively dual classed?
You're certainly effectively dual classed, but we do want to encourage you to play one or the other. This is getting into, to be honest, speculation.
No, and I realize you're still pretty early in development. Yeah. So
some ideas that we've talked about, you choosing what skills you slot into your hotbar. And if you choose all fighter skills, then you get a small boon to your overall weapons and your fighting ability. So it kind of encourages you to be pretty specific. And then if you will dual class, if you do half fighter skills and half cleric, then you've got more flexibility, but you lose that inherent boon of going one class at a time. So hopefully that helps reflect the paper product a little bit better in terms of that trade-off.
Out of curiosity, why would that be a goal for you to encourage people to chase after a single aspect of the character as they play? It's fine. I just am completely lost as to why that's a good thing.
It's, first of all, a balancing requirement. You know, it's very hard to balance somebody who wears the top armor in the game because he's a high-level fighter and he shoots a huge fireball because he's a high-level magic user and he heals himself constantly because he's a high-level cleric.
Yeah, that was UO in the 90s. And yeah. Ray 1 could do everything.
Sure, yeah. And so you kind of want to, without making it too terribly annoying, you want to give people mechanical reasons for focusing a little bit so that their role in the party is interesting and they have a particular purpose and not every player in the game plays exactly like every other player.
Okay, so I have a question. I've seen these very broad skill-based systems. I've seen character effectiveness caps, we'll call them. They're not level caps as such, handled in one of two different ways. The way we can both relate to is in Eve. In Eve, there are so many skills that one person, even with full implants and going forever, simply cannot have it all. And that's one way to do it. The other way is in UO and I think some other games, there's a pool of total skills that any one character is allowed. And they don't start at that pool, but they can usually get there pretty quickly. And then at their leisure, they can deliberately lose points in certain skills to free up other skills, ability to expand. So I guess my question is, how are you preventing everyone from learning everything? Is there going to be too much to learn? Is there going to be a total skill cap that you can monkey around with, or do you guys have a different solution?
No, I think we'll go the too much to learn route. I mean, it's that's why I'm putting it. I really hate the choosing to lose skills because I have an arbitrary cap on the total effectiveness of my character. That was also in Star Wars Galaxies.
Yeah,
I kind of hate those systems. It just feels very arbitrary. I think we are planning to just constantly add more classes over time and more trade skills and more crafting skills and more things for you to do over time, and we can kind of stay ahead of the players by doing that, especially since that's the other advantage of a time-based experience curve. We know how far people can possibly get, and as long as we keep staying ahead of them in more options, then we're giving them more and more game that they can participate in and more things that they can do without ever just running out of things to do.
Yeah, so I take it that the highest and most complex of skills, like in Eve, at their highest levels or even at some of their lower levels, will take a very long actual time to master. I mean, like, if you want to be a Titan pilot and you start now, you better start saving for 2015 when you can actually get in the damn thing.
Right. I think we'll try to stop short of the Titan pilot particular phenomenon. I mean, that's almost a super class that they essentially intended very few people to ever even get. But you're absolutely right that as the skills get higher in level, they take more and more time. I think we will try to break that up a little bit better. There's going to be a lot more sub-levels to skills. It kind of fits more naturally with Pathfinder anyway. You'll be leveling your fighter from level 1 to 20. In Eve, almost everything is essentially level 1 to 5, each of the skills. So yeah, that means you're waiting an awful long time for a ding.
Yeah, and there's horrible pyramids and flowcharts and other such not quite so geometrically simple structures of subsidiary skills that build on one another, and you have to have level 4 this to get level 2 that.
Flowcharts are never horrible, sir.
Then you should play Eve, Johan.
Right.
I shouldn't.
I played Eve for a long time, and it's funny, the skill system takes a lot of people aback, but if you start playing for a while, you start realizing pretty quickly that it fades into the background. It's not really that important. The game is about, you know, getting together friends. Yeah, scamming.
Sitting in Jita 4-4 and setting up a Ponzi scheme. That is what the game is about.
That's what the game's about. Yeah. You know, it's about the culture and about getting together with people. And the particular skills you have in your ship are just not that important. You do gain more effectiveness over time, but it's not a huge amount. And you
can't train lying, which is really what you need in Eve.
Yeah, you need to practice that a lot.
I want you to know that I intend to set up the first Ponzi scheme in Pathfinder Online when I'm not busy killing crafters and taking their crap and then just throwing it away because I don't even want to bother to carry it.
Well, this brings us to kind of a split point here.
Sure.
All the stuff that I've got here to talk about, and because we asked our forum community, what do you guys want us to ask whoever it is we get? At the time, your name was put forth, but I didn't know if it was you or Ryan or who we were going to get. So we're pleased to have you. But Mark, I'm going to
we really don't like Ryan that much.
But
you've already interviewed him.
Mark, I'm going to let you pick here. Do you want to talk about business side of things, the value proposition of the game, the Kickstarter, the ins and outs of how the creation of the game is structured, or would you rather instead talk about gameplay? Now, we're going to hit both. I'm just going to let you pick which one we hit first.
Let's finish our little PvP talk since we were starting to get into that question of what PvP is going to be like.
Let's talk about PvP.
That's where I was going to go. How are you going to contain reds me?
First of all, yeah, there is no PvE option in the game, at least as of right now. Last I have heard, there is no such thing as a PvE server. That is going to turn off a lot of people. I'm curious about two things.
And
one,
weak.
Yeah. One, why? And two, is there any limiter to PvP? For example, a renegade system, town guards, whatnot. So let's start with the first one. Why no PvE?
Well, I'll say real quick, there are a lot more limiters than Eve, and it's not really our intention to have this crazy Wild West feel that Eve has.
Damn it.
Well, not that it's not possible, but it's not really encouraged.
Oh, trust me, life finds a way.
Scumbag sure, John. Sure.
In terms of why, I think the biggest reason why, and this gets a little bit into business side, is that these type of sandbox games aren't really very meaningful without the possibility of battling. this game, Pathfinder Online, is about getting together with your friends and building a kingdom online. So you're actually going to build a town and train in that town and hire NPCs to do things for you in that town. And
Stop right there. Mm-hmm. You can hire NPCs. Talk about that for a moment. And I realize the game is not developed yet. It's in development. Okay, so I'm not asking you to commit to anything here. This is in development.
We can do an interview again. Yeah.
Well, we'll do an interview again. But the point is that I realize now everything's in development and everything's in flux. So I'm not asking you to commit to anything. And anyone who's listening, please take this as these are intense. These are not promised features. But what do you intend to have NPC hiring look like, and what can I hire an NPC to do?
Well, first of all, players are building the towns in this game. The towns are settlements, is what we call them. But over time, your settlement's going to grow into having huge stone walls and a large keep. It's going to turn into a castle. But there's a couple different things you can do, but you're hiring NPCs in order to run your town and build up things over time. So everything from even building a building requires you to hire a team of people to go to build it, to running a shop. So
why not use players?
That sounds boring.
I agree with you. Right click to hammer, right click to hammer, right click to hammer. Doing that for 12 hours a day to take home, a little bit of gold. I agree with you. It does
that
sound boring.
Exactly what it sounds like to me anytime anybody tells me about playing an MMO.
That is what most MMOs are like.
But my question, though, is, it sounds like many of these tasks could be sort of...
Well, it's certainly not the case that you aren't going to have people forming part of the economy.
Okay.
People are going to craft all of the best items in the game. There's a whole economy where the top-level adventurers are going to go out, kill some huge troll, take his stuff, and that stuff will include some basic magic components and bring it back to town, and then a high-level artificer will take those magic components to build a very good wand for the adventurers to go back out.
I was going to ask that a few minutes ago because that's what you'd mentioned. You touched on crafting and whatnot, and for me, a big part of MMO play is the crafting system and the economy that sort of can go with it, and oftentimes that just goes down the shitter with a lot of the MMOs where, you can craft, there's all these things that you can do, and you can level,
but the drops
are grind level up to 400, and then you can make this thing that'll take you 4 months to farm the shit for, but guess what? We just released a new patch, and this stuff that you can get is better than that. Or the best stuff is, you get it from raids. And so it's now, are you saying that it's the crafters that are going to be able to craft, like
the best stuff will always be done by the crafters, absolutely. We want them to be an integral part of the economy.
Is it only going to be available through the crafters, or will there be gear not from crafters, or is it only from crafters?
There will probably be lesser gear available directly from monsters, so that you can outfit yourself that way. But all the best gear comes from the crafters. And ideally what this means is that your guild has organized a good settlement, and you've recruited some number of people who just like the crafting game. And those people who are focused on the crafting game are building up all the items that you need in order to be successful adventurers and successful PvP players. And then you've got folks who are just interested in fighting in PvE and just fighting in the environs of the settlement. And you've got other people that are focused on just PvP and focus on some sort of war and grudge matches between you and nearby settlements.
Now, in the very early days of EverQuest 2, in fact, this may have been back even beta or pre-beta, I know it was way in the early days, they had intended to actually make craftsmen a class. I think they had four base classes, which was fighter, arcane caster, divine caster, rogue, which then split two or three times over into all the subclasses. You end up with some number of quite a few classes.
And then they split across the alignment arc.
Yeah,
there was one of them each for good and evil.
Yeah.
So there were a lot.
So yeah, there were a lot of classes in EverQuest 2. But in their original take of the game, being a craftsman was your base level class choice. Now they changed that. And once the game actually went into release, craftsman was something that you took in addition to your other class. But something that I'm curious about is, do you have to be a combatant to be a craftsman? Because in EverQuest, the theory was no. But the reality was yes, because if you actually wanted to grind out your crafting skills, if you actually wanted to produce anything, that really meant going out into the world and killing something to get it. And yeah. I'm curious, does this game actually support, let's say that all I want to do is wear an apron and sit in a shop all day and role play the surly blacksmith? Does this game, at least in theory, support that? Or is the reality that, no, at some point, I have to use that hammer to splatter a goblin skull, lest I have no raw materials to work with?
Right, right. No, absolutely it supports that. And in fact, you'll get a level in blacksmith. So
for splattering a goblin? No.
You'll have a level of your blacksmith skill. And you can absolutely just level up blacksmithing. This is honestly the biggest virtue, and this is why we're doing classless system in the first place. Class systems really struggle with this problem. You know, you pointed out EverQuest needing to have a craft class. Pirate of the Burning Sea actually shipped with a crafter class.
Who was excuse the pun.
Terrible at fighting. And was able to craft. It was a disaster, and it's not very fun to play that role. So, no, if you prefer to stay in town and do nothing but crafting, there's no problem with that, and you can absolutely do that. And that'll be a small segment of the population. I mean, there's some people who just absolutely love just doing that, and it'll be, you know, 1% of the population that just do nothing but try to become these very, very high-level crafters, and that's all they're interested in. They have to trade, then, for their components. So they get their components through the market from adventurers, and then they give back their high-level crafted items to the adventurers.
Is the market, is it going to be more like trading with your own guild, or is this going to be a traditional, like an auction house where it's across into a server-wide?
No, we would definitely want there to be geographic meaning to the items. So if your settlement moves into the hills, then you've got good iron sources nearby, and you have a much, much easier time building up good armor and good swords. But you don't have access to elven regions from the forest that you would need to get high-level magic items. Okay. And so there's an inherent element of push and pull and trade that's encouraged by the system.
Is there any safety from PvP? Is this a sort of game where anywhere, anytime, somebody can shank me and face effectively no repercussions for it?
There would definitely not be no repercussions for it. First of all, our objective is, we're not really interested in ganking. We want large-scale, interesting combat. What we're really, really very interested in is siege warfare between guilds. And so that's what we'll be encouraging. We also don't want there to be a complete sense of safety. You know, it's kind of interesting that you can get shanked, even if you ideally don't get shanked very often. We have a number of things that kind of keep down the amount of ganking that happens. So thing from NPC guards you can hire to be around your settlement, so you keep things safe for players in your settlement. To there's a whole flagging system, so if someone unfairly kills another player, then they're kind of open for retribution. So you can call your buddies and they'll come kill that guy and they don't suffer any penalties. And then the biggest element in this is that by doing things that are evil, like shanking somebody, you start pushing yourself more towards a chaotic evil alignment. And you kind of lose your alignment constantly over time. And there's some penalties to being chaotic evil. Your towns don't function as effectively as a lawful good town. And you, in general, have a few more problems to deal with. So it's something that you would prefer to be on the lawful good side. And there's a little bit of a constant penalty to people who are, you know, working against the rules and trying to, you know, annoy newbies.
Is that based more on the guild for the settlement? Because you're saying that it would influence, you know, not running the town as effectively. But that does that go beyond just the individual? Or are you talking about like the guild itself? Like the guild is, they're all being douches, like, you know, scumbag John, and ganking everybody.
Hey, yeah, I'm your not guild, a douche. I'm an entrepreneur.
Your guild has an alignment, and it's the average alignment of the members. So,
oh, okay, okay. So if John is the only one in the guild, it's okay to have one guy as long as the rest of them, you know, play it like
no, because I'm gonna pee in the water. There's gonna be some bonus for everyone being lawful good. It'll be like, John, stop killing the miners. They're defenseless, and you don't even want the loot. And I'll be like, no, and then I'll get kicked out, and then I'll start my own guild of evil superminds, and it'll go no. I don't know.
You were mentioning earlier that there was going to be an important trade factor, like inter-settlement trade, right, going on. Is that like load up a wagon load full of iron ore and drive it down to the elves?
Yeah, I don't know the full answer yet. There will certainly be an element that you can load up a wagon and go trade, and that might be profitable. I'm not sure that we want to
encourage it to get stolen by Scumbag John. Yeah, me too.
Well, I mean, yeah, Pat, you haven't played EVE, so this is hard to analogize, but you have, Mark, and like, yeah, if there's some super freighter that's sitting in my jump gate and I can web it, I'm going to do it.
The problem is sometimes that gameplay isn't as fun. So maybe there'll be a post system where you can just pay for items to be moved between towns. We'll see. there'll be some combination that hopefully works for the player base.
This is another question, or else maybe a bit too preliminary to answer, but you've been talking about these NPC hirelings. Can these NPCs only be hired at the town level, or can they be hired at the individual level? Let me give you two specific questions. Let's say I own a blacksmithing shop. Can I hire an NPC guard to just stand in the shop and protect me from Douchebag John?
It's Scumbag John.
Scumbag John. I'm sorry.
I would love that. To be honest, we haven't really thought that far. No, but I think that sounds really cool.
Totally fair. The second question is, do hirelings extend to adventuring? For example, let's say that I've got a great warrior and two great rogues, and we want to go out adventuring, but we don't have a healer. There was an MMO I played, and I can now for life me not think of what MMO it was, where you could go out and grab, let's say, a hireling healer that was basically a mob, except it was on your side, that would follow you around and play that role. And it didn't play it as well as a player would, but you nonetheless could pay this NPC to follow you around and carry on some kind of role. Do you guys intend to extend it to that, or is it more you want these guys basically...
That sounds cool. Yeah, I don't know. I haven't thought about it before, but that sounds very fun. So yeah, we should do that.
Okay.
Well, I've got another question about the NPCs. Is there like a loyalty factor with these guys? You know, like you're going to hire NPCs to basically guard their fortress, their stronghold. Are they just inherently loyal, or can a rival guild try to bribe them?
Right, that's a good question. We haven't really worked that out
Scumbag
yet. I'll hint at something else though that we have talked about wanting to have in the NPC realm. If you have a bunch of humans running your town, that's one thing. But what if your town NPCs, people building the buildings and maintaining things and whatnot, what if they're all goblins?
That would be amazing.
Uh-huh. That would be fantastic.
Especially if you were goblins.
Yeah.
Just a thought.
I'm not sure. Yeah, that's even farther. We'll think about that.
Yeah, okay. Somebody did list as one of their questions three times in a row, can they play a kobold? So I'll go ahead and get that out of the way. I assume they can't play a kobold.
Well, certainly not yet. Well, okay. We'd love to do stuff like that.
So what contributor level do I have to get in at to make Lizard Man playable for me?
Oh, we absolutely need to do Lizard Man. Well, the thing we were doing
is... put it up as a backer level. I might do it, okay? I'm just saying.
If you're Scumbag Chaotic Evil and you have goblin NPCs working for you, will they work better because they're afraid of you?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think there's going to be a correlation between being chaotic evil and wanting to have goblins in you.
Because I am A-okay with the net of the mechanical effects of being evil being negative. They certainly have been in most games that have reds and blues. Mm-hmm. But I want that little something-something that you can only do when you're CE. Like, the Helm of Disintegration is sitting out there, and I can use it, and they can't. So they have their flowers and their organization and their cooperation and their functionality. And
flushing toilets.
And I can have my sand pit with my trash pile and my little sleeping pallet and my Helm of Evil that I can blow them up with.
Exactly.
That's all I want, really.
All right. So I want to talk about something else here that I have seen in games that have used this kind of mechanic. And Eve and you will both come to mind. If you have this evolving world that is driven by the players, one of the things that I have really struggled with is breaking into that. When I tried to join up with Eve, the game was several years into its run, and I found that I was so far behind everybody and so far on the outside of most of the organizations that it was pretty much, unless I knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, I wasn't really going to make it anywhere. Or if I had a huge amount of ambition, no job, no spouse, then maybe I could get somewhere.
Well, I mean, also if you're something, if you're in a system like Eve, it's made even more difficult by the fact that you can't sit there and grind out for 24 hours a day to catch up.
Yeah. But you sort of can. I mean, even in Eve, and I suspect in Pathfinder, there will be resources that are trivially easy to obtain, but that all the guilds and organizations will need just billions of. Well, Veldspar comes to mind, but, rocks or whatever it's going to be in Pathfinder could be it. And by doing that, there will be people in the player economy who want your stuff. There will be a self-paced economic growth to that, because as they get more and more money from their super high-end stuff, they're competing with one another for your newbie rocks, and you can sort of get into
it. Let me give a more specific example here of a finite resource that this game brings up, which is where I'm going to tie it back to UO. In UO, the hardest thing to get in the game was 9 tiles to put a house on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so that was going to be one of my other questions. Let's say I come into this game 2 years after it's been released, or maybe I've been playing it forever, but it took me that long to convince my wife or one of my friends to join, and they sign up. And all of a sudden, they can't find any place in the world. But if they come in as a rock farmer, it's all they'll ever be, because all the high positions are taken. All the land that can be built on has been built on. What do you do to allow a place in the world for the new player or the casual player?
Cool. Yeah. So lots of answers here. The limited land resource problem. Shadowban had a huge problem with this, and actually,
yes, it did.
Shadowban had huge problems. I think that's a pretty
A lot of problems. But for people who enjoyed the game and were serious about it, you know, I know several guild members who were serious about the game, but they eventually got kicked out of their castle and they had nowhere to go. What we're actually planning to do with this game is our unit of land is what we call a hex, and it's set in the River Kingdoms. And these hexes are a pretty good area. We haven't figured out exactly how big, but probably 1 or 2 kilometers in size. And what we're planning to do is scale the size of the land over time with the player base. So as players come in the game, we're going to keep adding more and more land around the perimeter of the world so that the game is kind of constantly has a little bit more land for you. So if you want to join a small guild with 10 people, there's always going to be some bit of scrub land out in the middle of nowhere that you can call your own. And that really helps you get a place to go. And you don't have this problem of as soon as a guild gets forced out of their land with conflict, they have no place to go and reconstitute and relax and get back together as a guild.
Is that forcing going to be possible? Will there be a system like Baning and Shadowbane by which the ultimate result of siege warfare is a completely dispossessed organization and or destroyed town?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, excellent.
Siege warfare will destroy settlements. Absolutely.
That warms my heart so much, I might not be a turd and actually team up with people so I can accomplish that.
No.
But I'll warn you, just like in Eve.
You're right, I won't.
The powerful guilds are, strangely enough, the guilds that are friendly and can organize a lot of players.
The
fact is, the leveling curve is such that top level players are not that much more effective than low level players. So if you have a warm and friendly and happy guild that attracts a lot of newbie players, then you can field 500 people versus the very aggressive guild next door that can field 200 crazy veterans.
Or maybe, if you're the goon swarm that war. And you have a foreign service officer, God rest his soul, as a diplomat, that works.
Yep,
I mean, it's no coincidence that Sean Smith was actually a diplomat and rose to the top of EVE Online.
Strangely enough, in these type of games, just that level of organization and really being nice guy and getting along with others is a key element of your guild being successful.
Let me go and take this to a question that I think has probably been needing answering for the past 30 to 45 minutes. What happens when you die? I mean, in the game, I've been asking for
that for 45 minutes.
We just had a blog post on this, and I apologize, I haven't read it. There is some system by which you invest in your gear in order to keep it after you die. So you're investing some magical resource in keeping your gear. Our plans are for you to lose some element of coin or just economic force when you get killed, but it's not devastating, and you're not going to get all the items stripped off of your body or anything.
Aww.
Does the person that kill you get to take anything from you?
I think they might be able to break the threading and get a hold of one item.
I still will PK.
There's some sort of element like that. Yeah.
That sounds pretty similar to, I think it was Stark Age, wasn't it? That allowed you
yes.
to randomly roll three items
yeah.
off
there's
your
There's actually
or
elements of both UO and DAOC going at here. UO eventually implemented an insurance system by which there was a spell that just cost 500 or 600 gold that you could cast on each one of your items. And until your next death, it would respawn on you. Now, you had to have some cash in the bank to keep that shield up at all times. And I think that's what you kind of guys are going for here, Mark.
I believe so. I mean, I'm really talking out of turn because I know the system has been undergoing design, and I'm not that familiar with the latest design. I mean, certainly we want to have some economic penalty to you dying without it being devastating.
It sounds to me like gear will not be quite as almost entirely disposable as it was in UO. Losing all of your crap that you were carrying at the moment in UO was usually not disastrous at all, unless you were carrying like a house deed, which you should have never been doing.
Oh, I was carrying a house deed almost constantly in the search for a place to put the damn thing.
Okay. That aside, but it sounds to me, Mark, like in Pathfinder, the best of the best items are going to require a lot of cooperation. They're going to require your best raiders to go get the troll hearts. Then they're going to require your best artificers to make the items from the troll hearts. and that you don't want them to just be able to vanish off your body if you get PK'd one time. And I'm okay with that in a system where the items are really, really hard to get and they require rare components and mastery of everything. That makes more sense. Would I prefer generally a system where everything's disposable and everyone's killing each other all the time? Yes, but that doesn't sound like what Pathfinder MMO is going to be.
Yeah, that's not the intent.
So will you have an item within the game that is directly and obviously and clearly translatable into real-world currency, a la EVE? I am right.
Plex, yeah. Have it EVE that, right? Not only is Plex directly translatable, but there's a secondary market for it that adjusts itself as the relative value of the ISK continues to decline versus the US dollar.
Yeah. So this gets a little bit into economics. So the game, after we hit release, will probably be a hybrid model where you can either subscribe and constantly get a lot of benefits like leveling up your character and things like that, or you can participate in a marketplace where you've probably bought the initial game, like in Guild Wars, but you haven't kept resubscribing, and you can still play, and you have to purchase things through the store in order to do so. Now, I think Plex in EVE, and for your listeners, Plex is essentially an item in-game that represents one month subscription and is tradable between characters. It's really an interesting take. We may do something similar so that
is destroyable in game as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. that's the real killer thing about that stuff is you know, there is real actual currency value that gets destroyed on a constant basis.
Yeah, because of the existence of Plex, and if they do it in Pathfinder MMO, it'll be the same way. You can see how much something is worth in game credits, and then you can see how many game credits a dollar is worth, and you get these headlines that are like, okay, this guy just blew up a super freighter and destroyed $100,000 worth of crap in real life, and you know, because the currency has a fluid exchange rate with real money.
Well, that's something I have to be careful with, though, because that got Second Life in trouble. What was their currency? Was it
Linden Bucks or something like
Linden
that?
The Linden Bucks or the dollar. L or whatever it was. That got them in all kinds of trouble because of the fact that the IRS basically came in and said, look, if you can translate this into a direct correlation of this many Lindenbergs or whatever the hell they're called is worth this many dollars, then when you make a transaction or somebody makes income, that's income.
I think the ultimate counter argument to that, drawing from my extremely sparse knowledge of law outside of a criminal courtroom, is that you actually don't own anything you own in an MMORPG. The front end language says, you know, this is a game, this is a toy.
That's true.
Our server flakes on our server are not yours, even if your character owns them, etc.
Well, that was true until it got to the point that people would cash them out. And there were people that were making their yearly income off of that game.
Yeah.
Because they were able not just to buy into the game in their silly money, but then they were able to buy that out of the game into real dollars.
Okay, that is something
the IRS
EVE does not have.
Real upset about that.
And Mark, you can probably clarify this, but I'm almost certain Pathfinder will not have a system by which you can send Goblin Works Paizo Plex and they will send you US dollars.
Yeah, exactly. That definitely gets you into a lot of legal problems trying to do that. Actually, one of the best reasons for something like Plex, you know, it's a kind of a one-way transfer. So you're putting dollars into the game. There's no way of getting dollars back out. One of the best reasons is so that you kind of civilize the gold farming trade in your game. Regardless of whether you have the system or not, there's going to be gold farming, right? There's going to be some number of people in China who do nothing but try to get coin in your game and then sell that coin for real dollars to other players. If you have Plex, then it's essentially a way of putting that trade into the game. And the biggest reason is simply that the gold farming ecosystem is really, really terrible. I mean, people who buy currency from gold farmers are often getting huge numbers of viruses on their computers, and they'll get scammed out of money and get their credit card details stolen. And there's a lot of fraud in that market. And by bringing it into the game environment, you kind of civilize it a little bit. You just admit, well, you know, unfortunately, players are going to trade for gold in the game. So this trade is going to exist. Now there's at least a safe way to do it where, you know, it's all happening on the servers where we can see it and track it, and it's easier to deal with.
Yeah, and I suspect that like in EVE, in Pathfinder, you guys are aiming for a system where really simple entry-level repetitive gear that gold farmers tend to favor will not net you nearly enough money to compete with guilds of actual players who are doing complicated economic things, you know, trading, going for the good resources, making the artifacts. I mean, in a WoW-like system, gold farming makes perfect sense because all anyone does is right-click 200 times. In an EVE-like system, it doesn't make any sense because you need to have a squad, you need to go out to a wormhole, you need to get some gas, you need to smuggle it back in, you have to do all this stuff that is probably not worth trying to train a bunch of Chinese people who don't know what video games are to do.
And it's another way of saying that we hope that the game is just more interesting than that, that there's not just running around and getting gold. It's not really a very interesting use of your time.
So continuing this thought about breaking into an already established world, is there going to be a limited number of accounts per server? Can only 10,000 people join server X?
Right. So there's going to be one server.
Okay.
It's all one big server. Again, for this type of sandbox game, it just helps make the culture work a little bit better. It makes everything smoother.
And it's not going to be sharded or anything like that. So, if player A and player B are standing in neighboring coordinates, they will see each other. There is no possible situation under which they won't see each other, presuming no technical difficulties.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Okay. So that was that question.
It's tougher, makes my job tougher, but it makes for a much, much more fun game whenever, you know, you always can go see your buddy. You're never asking your buddy, what server is he on, and trying to figure out some way of rendezvousing and things like that.
Just out of curiosity, is there anything other than the inherent logistical difficulties of doing so that would prevent one guild from effectively winning the game by rolling through and just demolishing the settlement of every other guild?
First of all, there's hundreds of settlements, and I doubt that any single guild is going to be able to dominate that much land just in terms of organization and players and everything else. There will be some level of super guild organization, probably called a player nation, so that there will end up being large alliances of guilds that end up dividing the territory among themselves and warring over territory. Again, we always want to keep an area of land that is free, that is kind of out of the conflict zone, so there's always some place to go and nurse your wound if you've been knocked out in the Game of Thrones and in the more dominant territories.
Well, if I look back to EVE, human psychology and sociology also comes into play. The more people you get together and the more successful they are, the more quickly you get conflicting personalities.
Oh, sure.
Outside
and that's why
subterfuge.
I said, other than the inherent logistical problems of organizing that many people to do it.
Or is Chad is fond of saying, conquerors go up the palace steps in boots and come down them in slippers. Mm-hmm. And that alone tends to lead to the disintegration of an empire eventually.
Right. To a certain extent, it would be an interesting problem to have. It's never happened before, so we're not too worried about it.
Yeah, look, even the massive alliances in EVE have always managed to either forget to pay their bills or face rebellions or find equally potent opposing alliances. I mean, are you guys going to have a bunch of Russians on here who team up together and kill everybody? Is this going to be a global server?
Absolutely, yeah, one global server. So there is very likely going to be an area that is kind of dominated by the Russians, absolutely.
All right, we got to find the North Korean area. Repeat the invasion. What was that? So was it Reddit?
Our Murica invaded our Pyongyang a week or two ago, and our Pyongyang closed its borders for a while. So art imitates life.
A lot of the greatest stories in EVE come from this high level, you know, drama of what goes on between these huge factions. I mean, there's fantastic stories of the French and the Russians battling, and then, you know, it takes Russians, you know, months to figure out that the Americans are secretly shuttling supplies to the French to keep the battle going, you know. And it's crazy stuff that happens when you have thousands and thousands of players together vying over territory. And this is what we're interested in, you know. It's just like a really, really great campaign where you are driving the story. It's not driving you.
Yeah, I love it when games are so big that you need to actually have a foreign service to compete on the grand strategic scale.
Well, let me take this from the other angle, though. There's a lot of people out there that are more casual players that maybe don't have 100 friends they're going to play with, maybe even prefer playing solo. What kind of space is set aside in the game for someone who is a casual and or solo player?
So this kind of gets to the second part of your question I should have answered earlier. It's a couple of answers. There are a couple of newbie starter towns where you will be completely safe from any interference and you'll start your career there and you'll learn how to play the system before you get too involved in any risky areas. Though, but those are intended for new starting players. Past that point, I really want the large guilds to advertise for players to come join them, and I want them to actually hire an NPC that goes to the starter town and waves and says hi to the new players and says, you know, I'm offering a trip to this guild's territory. And if a player clicks on there, then they'll get transported very fast to that guild's territory.
I mean, ganked by John.
Shanked by John.
Yeah.
But,
yeah, you might want to make the landing pads variable. Just take it from a red. Like, we understand that the temples have guards and the moon gates have guards. We also understand that the approaches don't, and there's lots of defenseless people traveling them.
So, like has been said before, the guilds are participating in this game of guild warfare, but they need to have normal players doing normal things in their territory in order to succeed. So they have to have PvE players who are just fighting trolls and fighting goblins and fighting dragons and doing fantastic stuff in that area in order to compete in the other game. So they need to attract those players and set up a safe situation for them so they'll feel safe in the environs of this town, and then task the players with, well, we need to clear the goblins out of this forest.
Yeah, and certainly I do recognize that there's a value in that, that if a guild can offer me a role and can offer to keep me safe from John, then I am more likely to join up with that guild than to get, don't get me wrong, I'm sure on my first three attempts, I will get suckered out into going into Shankville.
Yes. John Corp would be happy to guard you while you go mine for an upfront fee. And everything you carried out with John as soon as you left the guard radius.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.